This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On the record charts, the 1980s was the decade of Born in the USA and Thriller. For a review of what happened beyond that in pop, Ken Tucker is with us. Ken is Fresh Air's rock critic and a staff writer for the new magazine Entertainment Weekly. Let's start things off with a song from his pick for the best album of the 1980s. So, Ken Tucker, what is this record from the album of the decade that we're listening to?
That's from an album called Get Happy. It was Elvis Costello's fourth album. It was released at the very beginning of the decade, 1980. That song was called I Stand Accused, and at the time, Elvis Costello was accused. I mean, he's phrasing that song as a love song, Girl, I Stand Accused. But one of the reasons that I find this album so fascinating is that, quite aside from its musical merits, which are extraordinary, 20 tracks, all of them, I think, in many ways, really wonderful, varied, beautiful songs that have sort of the high point of Elvis Costello's wordplay, there was something going on in his private life, which was that he had become involved in a drunken brawl while on tour in America with members of Stephen Stills' touring band, including Bonnie Bramlett. And he gave an interview at the time to Greil Marcus after the incident in Rolling Stone magazine, saying that he got very drunk and decided to say something that would infuriate these people that he had contempt for, Stephen Stills, Bonnie Bramlett, and musicians whom he saw as the most decadent sort of American musicians that he and punk rockers in England were reacting against. And he made a racial slur against Ray Charles and James Brown. It was something that he felt deeply ashamed of. Nothing in Elvis Costello's career prior to or subsequent to that would ever lead anyone to think he was a racist. But nevertheless, the publicity that that incident caused just branded him. He said to Greil Marcus, I'm sure that most people in America know me for this incident and not for my music, and I'm deeply ashamed of that. And he went into the studio 3 months later and recorded Get Happy, saying that what he wanted to do was to make his version of a Motown album. And I think it's just an amazing record. I think that it, in some ways, the Rolling Stone cover line at the time was Elvis Costello repents. And I think this was a great repentance for him.
Does this set the tone for you at all about the decade, having a record reacting against the excesses of certain rock musicians?
I think that's true. I mean, I think that at worst, you can say that the decade is framed by incidents like this, that something like this happens to Elvis Costello. By the end of the decade, 1989, Public Enemy is found members of the group making anti-Semitic remarks and having to call into question their, what I think is, and many other people think is, extraordinarily good music. I think that it's part of the controversy of the decade. I think that this was a decade unlike the 70s when the music became capable of shock and scandal again, that I think that this music became once again the field on which those kinds of controversies could emerge. And I think that that's really, although we're using bad examples, I think there are very good examples of good music that raised controversies that could not be done in any other field of popular art, that they, except for Spike Lee, were not being raised in the movies, questions of racism and sexism and issues of the Reagan era were being raised in popular music in a way that they weren't in movies, in television, in any other field.
Shall we play your record of the decade, the single of the decade that you've chosen?
Yes. This is George Clinton, and the song is called Atomic Dog. Nasty dog.
Why must I?
That's George Clinton and Atomic Dog, the record Ken has chosen as the single of the year. You know, it's just interesting to me that we're talking about all the issues that have been raised in pop music in the 80s, and your single of the year is really like a novelty tune in a lot of ways.
It is in a way, but it's also a tremendously influential piece of music. I mean, it sounds like there's this cat and dog jokiness, which is very typical of George Clinton. But at the same time, that riff that was heard in songs all throughout the decade. That song came out at the beginning of the decade. It was just enormously influential, and it carries on through. I'm glad I have the opportunity to explain this to your listeners. That is where Arsenio Hall's audience gets their woof woof chant that they chant at the beginning of Arsenio Hall show. I think it's very funny. I was just reading New Republic. There was a letter correcting someone saying, those Arsenio Hall audience members are saying the words roof, roof. And the New York Times had some other idea about where it came from. That's where it comes from. It comes from George Clinton. And Clinton is just both as a solo artist and with his groups Parliament and Funkadelic, I think an artist who never got kind of mainstream recognition in mainstream press, but it was just enormously influential. I mean, he's seen as a kind of godfather of rap music, for example, now.
You have an example of how that works.
That's right. Well, one of the ways that Clinton records is that he recorded this group, Funkadelic. There was a song called Not Just Knee Deep. And that song, years later, was used by the group De La Soul in 1989 for their song, Me, Myself, and I. I think if we played a little bit from Not Just Knee Deep, we could hear that.
Just to explain here, what a lot of the rappers have done in the 80s is do their raps over the rhythm tracks of other people's records. And this Funkadelic record is an example of a rhythm track that was used for a later rap by the group De La Soul.
Exactly.
So we'll start with Funkadelic?
Mm-hmm. So that's Not Just Knee Deep, recorded in the mid-80s. And then De La Soul, the way many rap groups do, took that riff that they really liked and admired and used it for their purposes in their 1989 song, Me, Myself, and I.
It's just me, myself, and I. It's just me, myself, and I.
I mean, I think you can hear that. I mean, that's as close as it comes to plagiarism, I suppose, in some sort of technical sense. And that's one of the controversies of the decade, whether rappers doing this were expressing a kind of creativity or whether they were just stealing. In that particular case, De La Soul was taking that Not Just Knee Deep riff from George Clinton, adding, scratching their own vocals, their own lyrical ideas. And Clinton thought it was great. I mean, he went on record as saying that he thinks that's wonderful. In the exact same track, there was a tiny, tiny, maybe 1 or 2 seconds long snippet from a Turtles song. And the Turtles, those aging 60s vets who don't seem to know what's going on, took great umbrage at this and have a lawsuit against De La Soul, which has yet to be settled. They claim that it was pure plagiarism of their music.
Are there any precedents now about whether using a rhythm track for a rap record is plagiarizing?
It's really up in the air. There are legal cases that are pending in a number of different records, but nothing's really come down one way or the other. There may be precedents in terms of, say, Bette Midler's recent suit about a sound-alike appearing on a commercial. She won that lawsuit, and so that may have some effect on that. But the legal issues are very hazy, and I think that it's interesting that that kind of artistic expression, which I think you can see back in kind of modernist art of collage, is being used in that kind of legal area now.
We were just talking about rap records. How do you think rap has changed in the 1980s? It really started, I mean, the first rap records were in the very late 70s. It was really in the 80s that it took off commercially.
Well, I think that just in terms of technology, the things that production has gotten a lot better, those kinds of transitions are made much more smoothly between the way bits and pieces of songs are taken and woven together in the course of a song. I also think that the subject matter is broadened considerably, that initially at the beginning of the decade, things were just a lot of rap music was about celebrating of the self, you know. A lot of raps were about, gee, I'm amazed I'm in a recording studio kind of thing.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of rap music as the decade went on took on lots of social issues, took on a lot of subjects, very sort of straightforward, ordinary life situations about being in school and dealing with your parents and that kind of thing. So I think that the subject matter ranged a lot more widely as the decade went on.
You were saying before that you think this has been an interesting decade in the sense that some of the predominant artists, some of the most interesting artists have been blacks and women.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, it was a real nose-thumbing to the idea that rock and roll is a white male establishment. I think that someone like Madonna and Prince showed themselves to be endlessly inventive musicians and were, when they first emerged at the beginning of the decade, artists that people thought really weren't going to have much of a career at all. I think that a record like Madonna's Like a Virgin was a really wonderful, bracing shock to popular music at the time. I mean, I think it's a wonderful track as music. I think that it completely negated the criticism of Madonna that she couldn't sing, that she wasn't a musician, that kind of thing, in addition to raising such a storm of controversy, which she continued by the end of the decade with another song, Like a Prayer. It's like a virgin, like a prayer. She's sort of the mistress of the simile in the decade. But, I mean, I think Like a Virgin really holds up as a solid record.
Why don't we give it a listen?
Sure.
Madonna's hit, Like a Virgin. You also mentioned Prince as being one of the outstanding figures in the 80s. Interesting, too, one thing he has in comparison with Madonna is that they both sing a lot about sex.
That's right. Yeah, and Prince managed to sustain that. I mean, everybody thought, oh, he released an album in 1980 called Dirty Mind, and which I thought was just a wonderful album. And everybody thought, well, you know, once he gets through with this sex theme, you know, this guy's going to go nowhere. You know, he's a novelty act. But that certainly hasn't proven to be true either. He's continued throughout the decade to make, I mean, very uneven, very ambitious. I mean, he's certainly had his share of dreadful records and bad movies that he's made. But I think that something like Dirty Mind, when I hear it now, it's almost inconceivable for that record to be released, in a sense. That given the current climate with the Parents Music Resource Center attacking records with explicit sexual content, that a track on Dirty Mind, like this one that we're going to play called Sister, that deals with incest, I mean, it's amazing that in the current climate this record could have been released back then, I think. Boy, is it getting hot in here or what?
Is this record an example of what you were talking about before, you know, about how rock was taking on issues that were very controversial, and suddenly people were getting upset and angry about the danger and the power of rock music again.
Yeah, well, I think when that record came out, it was such a total surprise because things like that just weren't appearing at the time, I don't think, very much. And there was certainly nothing organized like the PMRC to sort of come out and issue a formal statement. Whereas in 1989, you have things like the PMRC, you have really extraordinary moves like this past year. The rap group NWA came under attack by nothing less than the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which released a letter that was distributed to record retailers saying that they disapproved of one particular cut on an NWA rap album that was about shooting policemen. I mean, I think when you have government or semi-government bodies taking positions on music, I mean, that's something that in 1980 I don't think anyone could have anticipated.
And you think that's good?
I think what's good?
No, no.
I think it's awful.
You know, what I meant was you think that it's good that the music has so much teeth that it's arousing that kind of sentiment. I didn't mean to imply that you thought that potential censorship was...
Go FBI. Good. Boy, I could give you a list. No, no, I think it's wonderful. I think that especially when you contrast the fact that... I don't know if you remember the end of the 70s, Terry, but people were saying, oh, boy, the music's really done for. This disco stuff, it's ruined. This rap stuff. It's just noise and that kind of thing. And everybody was saying what a dull decade the 70s was. Well, I mean, I don't really believe that, but I think that if anything, the music got a lot livelier and got a lot more combative and did get a lot feistier over the course of this decade, which makes the music all the more interesting.
What were the biggest records of the 80s and how do they hold up?
Well, I think you have something like certainly Thriller was the best-selling. Michael Jackson's record Thriller was the best-selling album of the decade. Billboard magazine just published a decade-end issue that said that Thriller was the number one album for 2 years, which was unprecedented for 83 and 84. I think it's a absolutely amazing feat of record making. It's a wonderful album, but you could not get me to listen to Thriller if you held a gun to my head at this point. I just think it's an album that was so overplayed that was just the repetition of it just ruined it in a way. I think that was also true of Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA. I think when you have records like this, that's one thing that certainly came across, I think, in this decade when a record becomes so pervasive that other forms of media do seize on it, that it gets used in commercials, in politics, as Born in the USA was during one of the presidential campaigns in this decade. Things get just played into the ground, and the music gets ruined in some very fundamental way, that even though if you took these records to someone who had never heard them before, they could probably appreciate them. But I think it's almost impossible to have to come to them with a clear mind now.
Are there records that you thought were really good at the time that, looking back, don't really hold up that well?
Yeah, I was trying to sort of come up with a list of things that I thought were the best albums and singles of the decade, and there were things that I thought would certainly be on that list and then realized hadn't held up. I'm thinking specifically of David Byrne and Talking Heads, anything by Sting or The Police. I tried to put some of those records on and I thought, you know, I've heard this. It's received from other things. It's, you know, there are other sources of that music that are much more interesting than that music itself. I thought that was also true of the Irish group U2, which I've campaigned against over the course of this decade as being one of the most overrated acts I can imagine. And even something like Paul Simon's Graceland, which I do not discredit as a good record of itself, but received such media hype and such overkill that I think it ended up being overesteemed by many people. I think that in some ways Paul Simon's Graceland made people aware of world music and that's that sort of mini trend at the end of the decade. But it was not the second coming that it was publicized as being.
Well, since you brought up world music in that comment, let me ask you, I get the impression you're one of the holdouts on world music, that you're a little resistant to it.
I am, only in the sense that I guess this is a certain conservatism on my part. I'm not quite sure. I mean, the reason I love popular music is, one of the reasons is that I can understand the words, I can understand the cultural context from which it comes. Now, by understand the words, I don't mean I can make out the lyrics the way people complain that you can't understand the words. But I think that that sort of wholesale usurping of other cultures, while the music is interesting, it doesn't, for me, deliver the whole experience of what pop music can be. I can admire musicians from other countries, but I don't completely understand the cultural context. I don't claim to the way I think many people do who promote that music. And for me, I mean, I don't know. I feel awful even sort of saying it because I think that it sounds sort of jingoistic or something. But I do think that the idea is to understand pop music both from what's being said in the music and the music itself.
Shall we end this by making note of some of the people who died in the 80s?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the two biggest losses that I can think of were Roy Orbison and especially Marvin Gaye. I think that Marvin Gaye's death was especially tragic in that he had just released one of the strongest albums he'd ever made, and he was making a comeback. He had a wonderful number one hit single, Sexual Healing, which was a song that, as I think about it, at the end of the decade would have given the PMRC the willies. And he's someone who could have stood up to the PMRC. I would have loved to have seen dapper, eloquent Marvin Gaye dealing with Tipper Gore and her crew. And I think that it's one of the greatest losses.
Well, Ken, thanks a lot for talking with us about music of the past decade of the 1980s.
Well, thanks for having me.
Ken Tucker is rock critic for Fresh Air and also writes now for the new magazine Entertainment Weekly. I'm Terry Gross. This is Fresh Air, and let's close out with Marvin Gaye.